The National Security Advisor has agreed to take a few questions. I request Dr. Gupta to moderate this session.
Thank you, Chair. I am G.D. Sharma, member IDSA. I have the input from the various media's reports and other things, and at times we keep on hearing various things. Is there anyone overall in charge with the executive authority? Thank you.
Under the IT Act, there is. I think the best place to look for who has the authorities is in the law, in the IT Act itself. Please introduce yourself.
Hello, sir. My question is not regarding cybersecurity per se, but more regarding internet freedom. Now, the government, since the past 1 or 2 years, has been giving mixed signals regarding internet freedom, you know, with statements by Kapil Sibal suggesting that some content should not be allowed on the internet. So, does the government have a coherent policy as far as internet freedom is concerned? Because it has invited a lot of criticism internationally, India's stand on, you know, this issue. Thank you.
I think we have a very simple policy. We're for it. I mean, that's, but what content is objectionable, what is not, what do you do about it? This is a social issue. Ultimately, it's something that society and the polity decides within itself. Now, I think what Kapil Sibal was objecting to was some of the content that he saw being put on the internet. Now, that's one set of arguments. What do you do about that? If you find it objectionable, if you agree, and if you have a proper way among yourselves as a society, as a polity, to decide it's objectionable, what do you do with it? We have no interest in controlling the internet. I mean, somehow that, the fact that some content is objectionable and might have consequences in society, that has somehow been converted into a discussion of internet freedom, which frankly, they're unrelated entirely. It doesn't matter what medium you use. You would have the same argument whether you use film, whether you use television, you use radio, but there is something about the anonymity of the internet, and we have to admit this among ourselves, which tends to relax the normal inhibitions that apply to what people say and do. Maybe it's in the nature of the medium, I don't know. But that, as I said, has nothing to do with government's attitude to internet freedom. And certainly the simple answer is we're for it, that's it. But I think as a society, as a polity, I think it's natural that we sit and wonder about, you know, where do we draw the lines? How do we make it? How do we, and then how do we actually among ourselves make this work?
As we know that cybersecurity is emerging, my name is Deepak Roth from Microsoft. It's a new phenomenon world over, not maybe a couple of decades old. And several other countries have had the leader's advantage, either for having been attacked or having had the information infrastructure ahead of us. So as we are gearing up as a global leader, we all know that governments can do as much. They have to have participation from a very vibrant think tank community, if I call it academia, and a very vibrant public-private partnership model. It is so heartening to see IDSA step into this with this great report, and they'll do more of it, and there'll be more bodies doing this. The academia's job. What's the view on public-private partnership as regarding shaking hands with the private sector concerned and the government's view towards fighting cybersecurity and related challenges?
Actually, what we're planning is once we do what I said we're trying to do within government, on we will be actually talking to the DSCI, NASSCOM. We've already scheduled, you know, that we sit with them and outline what we think are our kinds of issues, talk to them, hear from them what we can do together, see how we can actually carry this forward. And we've scheduled it, I think, for the last week of June, isn't it? Because you're right, this can't be done just by government. Even just getting all of government together on one page is a job. But even after we've done that, we then need to actually get all of society, all, as I said, all the technological resources that we have among ourselves, we need to apply. And there's no question, the private sector is a big part of that. But also the labs, the universities, I mean, there's a lot of talent out there. There's a lot of people who know a lot about this. My own feeling, frankly, is that as India, we have two great opportunities, because one is we have what most countries don't have, which is the human resource that you need for this. Secondly, we're actually, it's almost Luddite. We are secure because we are not connected. Now, we therefore have an opportunity to leapfrog. We can actually put in place and do the best things that we need to. Trouble is, it's a moving target, and it's going to keep moving. So we should never say, okay, we found solutions. I think that's the wrong word. What we need is to have an architecture which enables us to deal with this as it grows, as it develops, and to do what we need to do. That's the way I look at it, and that will need working together. There's no other way of doing it.
Good morning, Frank Daniel from Reuters. You mentioned, that India was a target of many state and non-state cyber attacks. Please give a few more details.
Well, the problem in this field is attribution. If you read the report, it tells you, and it's very easy to suspect who's done it and where it's come from, but it's a global internet. You really don't know who is attacking you and where they're actually coming from. So some of it comes out in the open, some of it doesn't. That's the other problem with this field. People don't share. Nobody wants to say what happened to them, how they've been had. And people suspect each other. I mean, so if you look at international cooperation in this area, there's a lot of talk about, oh, we have to do cybersecurity together. But when it comes to the actual cooperation, there isn't that much. And it's a bit of a problem. So you ask me, tell me details, you won't get much.
Have there been any sort of large standout attacks that India has
dealt with recently? Take the Commonwealth Games, for instance. We had over 8,000 attacks on what for me is crazy. These are ticketing networks, these are scoring and timing and other networks. I mean, that's pure malice. I can't see any, you know, commercial advantage or any other, but for me that was staggering. The fact that you would have in those, 2.5 weeks, you had over 8,000 cyber attacks on the Commonwealth Games. I mean, that shows you that's only the tip of the iceberg, because that's not even a target that's really worth hitting. But there are other things worth going after in this country, and that's the problem.
Thank you, sir. I am Mehesh Jaladeva, a student of cyber security and cyber warfare for the past two decades or so. My question is this, that what are your views on ethical hacking, that too sponsored by the state?
Well, I think it's very hard to qualify when, as I said, this is a completely anarchic domain. There is no agreed definition of what's good, bad, who's, just because the state supports a hacker doesn't make him ethical or unethical. Since there are no agreed rules of war even in this, I find it very hard to use those terms, to use any adjectives in this actually.
Just a word, the term ethical hacking in the business actually is used for something very specific. These are really professional organizations which actually are security advisors. What you do is you go to this guy and he says, here's my system, try and hack into it. And the idea is for him to help us discover what are the vulnerabilities. I'll give you a very interesting example, which will maybe scare some of you. This was a nuclear power plant in Europe, and they had an ethical hacker. They said, our system is completely foolproof, the control system that we have. It is not connected in any way with the internet. There's no way anybody can get into it, but you try. That's what got into it. He got into the system which controlled the control rods. And then they asked him how. And the way he had done it was, there was a tiny sliver of a contact between the operating system and the management information system which was accessible to the managers. Basically, the tiny sliver of control was the production figure. this fellow got in through that and controlled it. Now, that's an ethical hacker. And the idea is that that ethical hacker, and I would strongly recommend that companies, etc., should actually hire the services of an ethical hacker. There's an annual conference. An annual conference which is held generally in Las Vegas, and about half the people there are security people, but the other half are the hackers. But there is, these are the things we should start doing. Commercial organizations, private organizations start doing this. So ethical hacking actually isn't in the trade, really means people are providing this professional service.
Thank you, sir. Sundar from IDSA. You yourself mentioned lack of conceptual frameworks. So when we don't have conceptual frameworks in place, how do we formulate a policy? And with lack of frameworks, besides you have technological developments that governments are really finding it difficult to keep up with. So how does the NSC formulate policies when we don't have conceptual frameworks in place?
You know, if you wait for perfect knowledge, you'll never form any policies. I don't think we have a proper conceptual framework to understand how international relations work. But that doesn't mean we don't have a foreign policy. I mean, you know, just because we don't understand war in all its manifestations doesn't mean we don't conduct it. We don't have a defense ministry, an army, etc. You know, so let's not frighten ourselves with lack of conceptual clarity. You'll have conceptual clarity 7,000 years after all this is over, maybe. But that doesn't mean we don't have to do what we have to do. Secondly, as I said, I'm not claiming that government knows everything or that government knows the technology. But it's more than technology. It's not just a technology issue here. But government has to work with those who have knowledge of this, including, as I said, the labs, the scientists, the technologists, the firms, everyone. But the reason I said government is trying to evolve an architecture is because we're not laying down a policy cast in stone. These are not something that here it is, rigorous, clear, this is what we'll follow for all time to come. No, because it's exactly the reasons that you said, the lack of clarity, the fact that it's evolving so fast, we will have to create an architecture which can deal with this and can learn as it grows. And I think that's not beyond our capability. I think we've done it before, we'll do it again. I'm not so pessimistic about it. In fact, I think the joy of it is actually looking, because you have so much space to actually work in. And as I said, because we are really starting afresh, we can do this for ourselves as India. We can actually think for ourselves and put systems in place of our own. We don't have to go around imitating what other people do.
Hardware end of cybersecurity. And the fact that cybersecurity can be, conflicts can remain in cyberspace, but they can also go out of cyberspace when they will just integrate with the land, sea, air warfare. So it is not just such an independent domain as you think it to be. As far as hardware issues are concerned, I mean, what we are discussing basically are the applications and the software end of the cybersecurity. What is the government's thoughts on the vulnerabilities in the hardware domain in a country which is importing most of its ICT hardware? And what policy measures do we wish to put in place to reverse this trend?
That's a one-hour lecture on its own, but I'd suggest that in the session after this in the panel, you talk to Gulshan Rai about it. He'll tell you all about it. He knows, and he'll tell you exactly what government is looking at, what we've done in the last year and a half or so, and where we're going with this. I think that's rather than, because it's a huge subject, as you said.
So I'm General Kumar. I'm General Kumar, sir, and my question relates to the protection of the citizen from the blackmail that is on the net with regard to privacy policies. Like, you want to get into this, please sign it, as I will not let you have it. You want an access. So you just say yes, and then the next page appears. That's one part of it, sir. And the second part is the protection of the data centers and the government's policy to hold the data centers within the national boundaries. Thank you.
I think there's, you know, there's technological problems with both, but there's also issues of legal authority to actually do these things today in our situation. part of what we're going to be doing with the private sector and the others is actually to discuss these issues, these kinds of issues. Exactly what you said. What do you do? But because frankly, today with the cloud, with the way the internet works, these national boundaries might apply notionally, might apply legally, but they don't actually work in practice in on any of these. And it's a huge issue of what do we therefore do to secure ourselves in this, given this. I mean, we have to take this for granted. You can't cut yourself off from it. You can't do without it. About individuals' rights to privacy, we've been working for the last, well, now 2 years on a privacy law also, because I think, and we also need to start looking at data retention and data protection. There's a whole set of things that we've identified which we need to be doing, which we hope to roll out as part of this. We'll come to ultimately we need to put all this out, have a big discussion among ourselves, and then start working on these things among ourselves. It's
Good morning, Ambassador Menon. Geeta Mohan from Times Now. My question is, how serious and how much of a threat does India face from the neighborhood countries like China, Pakistan, intelligence agencies from those countries, and terrorist organizations from Pakistan?
As I said, these things can't be attributed, one. Two, my job, and I'm paid, like certain other people in government, to think bad thoughts and to prepare for them and to make sure they don't happen. And that's what we do. So I can't give you, there is no accepted international metric which tells you, okay, you can measure a level of threat, how much, what they've done by this. If you take A plus B plus C, it'll equal so much. There's no such thing. So when you say how much is the threat, what you get is somebody's personal opinion. That's it. And it's not worth very much, quite frankly.
But it exists.